The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Welcome to the Fandom Files. We're a Sci-Fi Wire podcast about people who really, really love stuff. I'm Jordan Zachern, the features editor here at Sci-Fi Wire, and I'm flying solo tonight because my good pal and co-host, Emily Gaudette, is on her way to Nashville. I'm also doing some traveling. Tomorrow, I'm headed to L.A., Los Angeles. As if you didn't know what L.A. was. Sorry about that. I don't know why I had to identify that. I'm going for the premiere of Solo, a Star Wars story. You may have heard of it. It's another prequel. I don't know why they don't call these movies prequels. Maybe that has just been ruined for Star Wars fans. I don't know. Anyways, I'm going for the premiere. We're going to do some interviews. I'll probably get caught in traffic, see a few friends who went out to L.A. to live, get caught in some more traffic. Then I'm going to see Deadpool and then take a red-eye flight back to interview the director of Deadpool in New York on Tuesday. I'm excited and already really tired, but I will not say any more about that because I just sound like an asshole complaining about being tired about doing such cool things for my job. See? I sound like an asshole. Anyways, I have a sensitive side. Today's episode was inspired by an experience I had a few months ago, sort of a classic final coming-of-age moment. My parents, they sold their house in Jersey. I lived in that house from ages 10 to 18, so I had a lot of stuff there. You know, all the stuff moved from our first house or second house to that house, and all my crap was still there, apparently. I took a train out to Jersey to go through it all, and either my parents are really sentimental or they're hoarders, or like maybe both. Either way, they had a ton of stuff, like so much of my schoolwork and video games and comic books, just stuff that I thought were long gone, stuff I hadn't even thought about for years and years and years. And the thing is, once I found out they still had it, though, I got a bit nostalgic myself, which is kind of rare for me. I felt weird throwing away the stuff from my childhood, even though I already kind of thought it had been thrown away and just had no idea it still existed up to that moment. Like books I made in fifth grade and, you know, toys and Ninja Turtle stuff and comic books, a lot of Spider-Man stuff. And I couldn't take that much home with me since my girlfriend Julia just moved into my studio apartment. And it's very tight and we had to get our own storage unit for a lot of her stuff. And so she was very kind saying, yeah, I can keep more. You can bring stuff. That's okay. Don't have to throw it out. But like, I wasn't going to do that to her and I didn't want to be responsible for us living like hoarders. I'm already enough of a pack rat with all my Godzilla stuff at home. And so anyway, I kept a few comics, some baseball stuff from when I worked in baseball and being a fan and some just weird things I made over the years. But a lot of it went away. My parents kept some old video game consoles and whatnot, but a lot of it just had to be donated or thrown out. And it got me thinking about nostalgia and prized possessions, collections and stuff we can't get rid of. I've had to move so many apartments in New York. I've had like 8 or 9 apartments in New York in a decade, which is insane. Unhealthy, probably. And I'm going to be moving again in the fall. So I'm not someone who has a lot of stuff just because of that. But some people, they collect their whole lives. And they're much more attached to their things because it has meaning and they have room. And so I wanted to talk to the king of geek collections, and that is Bob Rattal, who owns the largest comic book collection in the world. I just Googled it last night. And I found him and he was down to talk, which is pretty awesome. So we're going to bring on Bob now. And so here is Bob Rattal. I mispronounced his name in my introduction. I'm very sorry, Bob. How's it going?
Very good. Very good.
Awesome. Well, look, thanks for taking the time to talk with me. I was looking around for, as I explained in my intro, people with big collections last night, and you have the biggest comic book collection in the world. What is the number at right now?
Oh, it's somewhere north of probably 105,000 unique comic books.
Oh, wow.
I haven't redone the count for Guinness in close to 2 years.
Do they come and ask?
I can update it with them. I've updated it once since I set the record initially, but it was there were a lot of hoops to jump through with the first time.
What was that process kind of like?
Basically, what had to happen was I had to do a count of my collection, which means I had to clean things up because you can't count duplicate comics.
Got it.
So, you know, a lot of people who buy, let's have, you know, 10 copies of this comic book because it's going to be worth a lot of money, or, you know, or dealers who, you know, just have, you know, hundreds and hundreds of copies of the same thing because they buy collections and stuff. You know, it's just unique, different comic books. So I had to deduplicate my collection, and I ended up having about 2,000 duplicate comics I had collected over the years, mostly not on purpose. But, you know, if you read comics, you know, you go to like a store and they're having a 50 cent sale or something, and you're just like, oh, let me get all these comics, and you get home and you're like, oh, I already have these. So I ended up giving those away. I had the unerring superpower that any comic that I would end up having duplicates of was completely worthless. I didn't have like a big stack of Hulk 181s or anything like that. But, you know, just a lot of random stuff.
Right.
The Guinness guys, I had to have a public event. And that's the one really tricky part, is you have to have a public event. Well, it turned out I was doing a panel at the Long Beach Comic Con about collecting comics that year, and I just handed out a flyer at my panel and at the con, and said, okay, on this day, we're having this Guinness counting event at my house. Come on by. And, you know, that's not, I had a little over 100 people showed up. It's not like, you know, I had like thousands of people swarming my neighborhood or anything, I had to have a couple of people verify it and do affidavits on it. One of them is a guy I know down in San Diego, who used to be a forensic accountant and now he sells comics. The other one was a guy who owns a local comic shop that I go to that's been in business for 30 years. At that time, you know, a little less. They just had their 30th anniversary. Hmm. So, you know, these are people who are kind of authorities on
right.
this thing. And they didn't make them count like every single comic individually. What we did is, since I have my comics all in a database, is, well, what the accountant guy did was he pulled out 5 or 6 boxes, long boxes, from the collection and counted all the comics in those boxes. And then we went to my database and said, how many comics does my database say is in that box? And when the number matched, it's like, okay,
right,
that's good. And then he went and he visually made sure he saw every one of the boxes in the collection, which at that time was something like 360 long boxes and maybe 20 some odd magazine boxes and some number of short boxes. You know how that goes. You keep them in different places. But I've got them all with numbers written on them with a black Sharpie. So it's pretty easy to just go and check and make sure. And then as a final step, he went and he picked like 20 comic books at random out of the database. You know, like he would say 4212, and I'd look it up in the database and it would say, oh, that's supposed to be in box 152. So I'd go over, I pulled out box 152 and went through alphabetically, and I'd pull out that issue of Thor. And, you know, at that point, it would be a pretty difficult and elaborate ruse if all those things checked out and you didn't actually have the total that the database was saying that you had. It's had. So that was how we did it without counting 100,000 comic books individually. And that was acceptable to the Guinness folks.
Yeah, it would be insane if you were went through all that work to trick them.
Exactly. So, you know, at this point, since I've already done that, plus we had to like film the whole thing, and, you know, there was a lot of other, you know, photos and affidavits and other kinds of things that we had to do. But at this point, you know, they verified some of the people that I buy the comic books from and, you know, all that. And they're all, oh, yeah, this guy buys like a crazy ass amount of comics, you know, all the time. So, you know, it's just they kind of know that I have all these comics. So at this point, if I just send them a dump of my database, you know, they look at the count in there and it's like it went up X amount in the last 2 years. And it's like, well, that's, you know, kind of on track with, you know, what he normally does. They believe the update. again, you know, if I'm faking it at that point, it doesn't seem like it would be worth the, you know, the effort to do, you know, it'd be a lot of effort to fake something like that.
I feel like you would just deserve the award for faking it all, either way.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, the thing that I also say that distinguishes me, I mean, there are people that have more comics than I do. Mm-hmm. You know, there are a lot of comic book dealers who have more comics. You know, certainly the guy who owns Diamond Comics and has that, you know, Steve Jeppy, who has Jeppy's Comic Museum in Baltimore, which I've been to and it's phenomenal, right by the Orioles ballpark. You know, he's got more comics than I do, but... You know, geez, the guy like owns the largest comic book distributor in the world. And you know, right. it's not like he's like a guy buying and reading, you know, comics every month. It's his business. And the same thing with someone like Chuck Rosansky, who runs Mile High, or Buddy Saunders, who owns mycomicshop.com. I've talked to both Buddy and Chuck Rosansky, and they're both, you know, so yeah, you know, we have our own personal collections. And, you know, we have tons of duplicates, and they both told me, it's like, wow, you have an awesome amount of comic books for just some, you know, a fan who's been buying these all off the rack and not buying them as collections. You know, a lot of people who amass a lot of comic books buy a collection of, you know, 2,000 comic books or 5,000 comic books. And I've never done that. I've bought all mine one by one, mostly, although, you know, Free Comic Book Day was last Saturday. I came away from a sale at a local shop with about 400 comic books.
Oh, my
so,
God.
You know?
How, so you got 400 comic books last weekend. How long does it take you? One, how did you get them home? And two, how long does it take you to read that number of comic books? Or do you read them all?
Yeah, I do read them. Comic books is deceptively small amount of comic books size-wise. It's have you been in a comic box? You know those diamond boxes that the comics come to the stores in?
Yeah.
The brown ones?
Sure.
But they get, you know, usually most comic shops, if you go to one on a Wednesday, they got these things laying all over. They're throwing them out, you know, recycling them or something. It basically filled two of those boxes with about 400 comic books.
Got it.
So it's not, because they weren't bagged and boarded.
Got it. Okay.
When they get bagged and boarded, they take up a little more room. But, sure. You know, on the time it takes, I have a good analogy, and that is I don't watch sports. Mm-hmm. A lot of people love sports. A lot of people watch, you know, baseball games, football games, basketball games, whatever. These games take about 3 hours, right, sure, to get from start to finish. It takes me maybe 10 minutes to read a comic book, so that's about 6 comic books in an hour.
Okay.
In a 3-hour game, that's 18 comic books, right? So if I would watch 2 ball games on a weekend, that's about 35 comic books approximately, you know? Sure. So that's my kind of normal fare. You know, if I spend 5 or 6 hours a week reading comics, I could easily read what I buy in a week, plus when I get like kind of extra ones at things like the Free Comic Book Day sale. Because another thing that is sort of different about, I'm older, you know, I'm 56. I started reading comics when I was 8. So I've been buying and reading them every month for 48 years, right?
Right.
A long time.
Impressive.
I never went through the phase where it was like, I'm going to stop reading books and sell them all. So that's why I accumulated them all. But the other thing I didn't do was I never hit that point where you find a lot of the older fans who get all disillusioned because they're just reading superhero comic books. And they say, oh man, they haven't written a good comic book since, you know, fill in the blank year. That's like some really long time in the past. Right. I've morphed over the years, and it's like when I started getting tired of, you know, certain superhero books, I started reading indie books, and I read a lot of Image Comics and Dynamite and Dark Horse and IDW and all the different publishers and all different genres of comic books. And, you know, I have always found there to be lots of interesting comics to read every month that come out. So I'm always reading new comics. And then I also continue to buy back issues, and I still read back issues of comics. So I kind of don't have a bias one way or the other on comics. I just like good stories, and I like characters.
What are you reading? So you talk about, I know you started with Spider-Man. That was your first one. What are you really into right now? Are you back on superheroes? A certain thing you're really into? Are you reading a lot?
Yeah, I mean, I read a certain amount of superhero books. I mean, I buy probably about 120 new books a month. And of those 120 new books, about 35 of them are superhero books from Marvel and DC.
Okay.
And the rest are indie books. So, you know, like my top favorite book right now is a book called Giant Days from Boom. I don't know if you've heard of that one.
I know Boom, obviously, but I haven't heard that one. Which one is that?
Giant Days is about these kids in college in the UK.
Okay.
I am certainly not the target demographic to this book, but I love it.
That's the fun of it, though.
I love The Walking Dead still. I read Saga. That's one of my top favorites. Harry County from Dark Horse by Cullen Bunn. And that one's just about ending, so that'll kind of leave a hole in my top favorites. I love Astro City, Bullets, Manifest Destiny, you know, things like that. And then in the superhero stuff, some of my favorite stuff are the books that have, like, really pissed off a lot of other gray-bearded, old-timey comic book collectors.
Oh, like what?
For some reason. Like, I love Riri Williams as Ironheart.
Which is great.
You know? I think she's great. I love Squirrel Girl. I love Jane Foster as Thor. I don't sit back and say, gee, in my day, you know, Iron Man was a white guy. You know,
right.
Like, yeah, you know, I've got like literally like probably 1,000 Tony Stark Iron Man comic books. I don't need to have them print another one of those for me every single one. Particularly, I could read any of those old ones if I want. I really like Riri Williams as a character. I like Jessica Jones. You know, I like a lot of these new characters. When they do something new and different to me, that's great because I look from two respects. One, they're telling a different story because a lot of these things I've seen happen before, you know, over time, and they're kind of feel like retreads a little bit with the same characters. So I like when they bring a new twist to it. And the other side is, I am really, really happy whenever I open up the letters page of one of these comics and I see like little girls or little boys, you know, sending the picture of themselves in the, you know, Squirrel Girl costume or something and saying, gee, I love this comic. And it was so exciting. And, you know, it's just like, I love that they're doing some comic book that is getting some kids excited about reading comics and is like growing new fans.
Right.
You know, that makes me happy.
That's a huge part of it because you're right. Like, even to when, you know, Batman, the TV show came out, people were mad that, you know, it wasn't like Batman, the comic book, even though that comic book had only been around for so long. People forever have been mad that things weren't like they were in the old days. Whereas, like you said, those books still exist. You can go back and read them. Why not try something new?
Right. And just the variety of different things that they try, that's what I like. I look at it as, and I don't like every comic book that comes out, obviously. If I don't like something, I try really hard not to say that it's bad. I try to say, well, I didn't like that. You know, it's just, that doesn't mean that it's bad. It just means that I didn't like it. And I'll tell you, any publisher's doing something wrong if I like everything that they're doing, because I'm not the only target demographic and I'm not even like the main target demographic for these things. So they should be doing stuff that doesn't click with me, because that means they're reaching out to a more diverse audience. And that I do like as much weird stuff as I do is actually, I look at it as, because I like all different art styles and I like, you know, all different takes on creators and heroes, and even just things that aren't heroes when we look at, you know, things like Harrow County and Saga and Stray Bullets and, you know, all these other ones, because it's another thing that helps me keep 100-some-odd comics straight in my head. Another question I get asked is, man, you're reading, you know, 120 comic books every month. How in the world do you keep all those straight? And it's like, well, if my 120 comics were all superhero comics from Marvel and DC, I guarantee you I would not be able to keep them all straight in my head, because there's a certain amount of, you know,
they can't keep them straight.
They start to blur together on me, you know, but it's like, I don't have any trouble at all keeping Harrow County straight in my mind from Saga or from Stray Bullets or any of these other books, because they're just so different and the characters are so different. The art style is so different.
Right.
You know, it's just, they're very unique comic books, and it kind of keeps in my head, they're sort of partitioned, and I can very easily keep all the stories and characters straight.
You know, I know you, the first thing you read when you were a kid, I read this about you, was Spider-Man. What was it about Spider-Man and that comic book that just set you off on this, this like 40-year adventure?
You know, the first one I read was Amazing Spider-Man 88. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Stan Lee wrote it. John Romita Sr. drew it. I had read comic books before. My older brothers had comics. There had been, I know I had read some random Justice League, Batman, Uncle Scrooge, Richie Rich, you know, things like that that were just laying around the house. But that Spider-Man book was the first one that I went to the store and flipped through and bought with my own money.
Okay.
And went back. And it was kind of, you know, Spider-Man was fighting Doc Ock in that book. And it's just, it wasn't, I think what I like about Spider-Man in general is that Peter Parker and his supporting cast takes just as much a role in a lot of those stories as the superheroics. So they're kind of balanced. I remember from that first book, I know that, you know, we had J. Jonah Jameson in it. We had Gwen Stacy, and I think Harry Osborn was in it. I'm not exactly sure. But, you know, we had all these different characters in it in addition to just having Spider-Man. And at the end, we had not completely a cliffhanger, but Spider-Man was trying to get Doc Ock, who was hijacking a plane, and at the end this plane blows up, and it's kind of like, you know, Spider-Man's like, man, can I be sure Doc Ock is dead? And then on the next month when I saw the Spider-Man one, well, you see Doc Ock arms and stuff again. Mm-hmm. So you know, oh, well, he made it through. How'd that happen? You know, so you just, I read it, and then I liked that again, and it's just the way that the stories were written, they gave me a complete piece of story in each issue, but there was also kind of a little hook at the end that made me want to come back for the next month.
Right.
I find the same style of writing is present in a lot of the books that I like. You know, Kirkman does that really good in the Walking Dead monthly comics. He puts some kind of forward movement, some character development, some kind of significant thing. You know, I feel like I got a satisfying chunk of story in each issue, and then he ends it on some kind of a story beat that's like, uh-oh, what happens next? And that's how you hook people on these serial fiction. And it's like a soap opera, really, any of these serialized comics.
Sure.
Are.
And so people, famously the Spider-Man is the first one you bought with your own money. What was the second? When you went back to the comic book shop, whether it was the next day or the next month, what were the next ones you got? Was it still Spider-Man? Were they other superheroes or other titles in general?
For a while, it was Spider-Man. You know, I got Spider-Man 88 and then 89 and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And I was just getting Spider-Man for about the first year, or maybe a little more. I remember at some point in there, I discovered Marvel Tales. I don't know how old you are, if you remember, but Marvel Tales, was the reprint book, and it reprinted older issues of Spider-Man. Of course, back in these days, there were no collected editions, So you couldn't just, you know, there were no digital comics. You couldn't just go and get old issues of these comics. So when I saw Marvel Tales, it was like, oh, well, there's just another Spider-Man book. And it was reprinting Spider-Man books from, you know, probably like 5 years previously. But as far as I was concerned, those were new Spider-Man stories I hadn't read before. And, you know, they were also by Stan Lee and John Romita. So it was almost like I was getting two Spider-Man books a month. Okay. It wasn't until like maybe about 2 years in, I think I picked up Daredevil and I started getting Daredevil each month. And right around that same time, another Spider-Man connection, I started picking up Marvel Team-Up because that debuted in 1972, I think. So, you know, that was maybe a year and a half after I started. So, I started picking up Marvel Team-Up. And now when I'm reading Marvel Team-Up, it's Spider-Man and somebody else. So that introduces me to these other Marvel heroes. And then pretty soon I picked up Captain America and Fantastic Four and Avengers, et cetera. And then I was kind of rolling and I started reading most of the Marvel books. So probably by around 2.5 years in, I'm maybe 10, 11 years old. I'm full on Marvel zombie. You know, this is like back, I would buy anything with the Marvel logo on it. You know, I was buying Kid Colt, Outlaw, you know, Where Monsters Dwell, you know, just any of these books that had the Marvel logo and all the superhero stuff, of course. And I didn't buy my first DC book until probably it was like when Warlord came out. I think it was about 1976.
And what? So what was it that about Warlord that finally made you go over to DC? Were you hesitant about DC, or were you just so in love with Marvel that you just didn't think about going to DC?
I don't remember exactly. All I know is that I loved Conan. And I was reading the John Buscema, Roy Thomas, Conan book, and Warlord was kind of another one in that vein, you know, but this guy had a Magnum pistol and he had that cool helmet with the big feathers on it and stuff. And I just saw that on the rack and I was like, this looks cool.
Yeah.
And it was like, it had just started. I mean, Warlord, it was like brand new when I started reading it. So it's not like I had been dismissing Warlord for years. It just, they only started putting Warlord out in 76. So I jumped onto Warlord right early, like either issue one or two of that book. And I started reading that. And then I switched over maybe 6-8 months after that to reading Green Lantern. Mm-hmm. And that was Green Lantern and Green Arrow at the time. Okay. And I really liked Green Lantern for some reason. I liked him because anybody could get that ring and put it on and be Green Lantern. I didn't have to have my parents murdered before my eyes as a child. You know, I didn't have to be from the planet Krypton or, you know, something like that. It's just like, hey, some alien could come up and say, here you go, have this ring. And, you know, I put it on and I'm Green Lantern. So I liked Green Lantern. And then I moved out from that. Mike Grell was the artist on that. And because I like, well, that was probably why I went to Green Lantern, because Mike Grell did Warlord, right. And then I noticed the art style was similar to Green Lantern, and that was when Green Lantern came back after that short hiatus after the Neil Adams, Denny O'Neill run.
Right,
they stopped doing Green Lantern for a while, and then when he came back at issue 90, I think, the Mike Grell was the artist. So I started reading that. And then Grell was also doing Superboy and the Legion of Superheroes. So I started reading that. And then I went from there to Justice League. And then I, you know, by that point, by the late 70s, I was reading most all of the Marvel book. I mean, Marvel and DC. I switched out, but there weren't as many books back then. You know, they weren't putting out like 90 books a month like they are now. I mean, each publisher put out maybe 20 or something.
So here's a so you were still putting, you're still, I mean, you're a young guy collecting all these comic books. Obviously, like, your brother was into it. Was there did you keep every comic book that you bought at the time, or did you throw them out when you were, like, you know, when you were done with them? Because I know that my dad, for instance, was a big fan of, he loved baseball, and I love baseball, and I mean, I love comic books too, but he would say he had all these, like, incredible baseball cards, rookie cards, and he had some comic books too, you know, he was into, and they didn't think really much of it, you know, oh, we don't have much room in our home, and these are red already, or I looked at the stats of the baseball cards, so I threw it out. But you were prescient enough to just keep it all?
Yeah, I did. I never threw out a comic book. Now, I did destroy my first year or so of Spider-Man comic books. I mean, I'm like eight. I mean, back in the day, I used to, what do I know? I'm a stupid little kid, right? I mean, I would cut the Spider-Man figures out of the comic books and make little paper dolls with them and make my own little Spider-Man adventures. So I, like, cut up, like, from Spider-Man 88 through probably about 95 or 96.
That's really funny.
I cut them all up. And I've subsequently rebought those issues. Sure. In fact, I rebought those back in the, you know, probably late 70s, early 80s when I was a teenager. So it's not like I, you know, they weren't that expensive to replace. But, you know, those are the ones that I didn't keep. I threw those out because, and then, of course, when they came out with Marvel value stamps, I did chop the Marvel value stamps out of 100 comic books and paste them to the Marvel value stamp book that it sent away from. So I've destroyed a sizable, small number of comic books in my day. I don't do that anymore.
I think you're a pretty decent archivist, though. I think, you know, you knew early on that to keep hold on to these things.
Yeah, and, you know, these were before bag and board days, but I would take, I remember, like, Glad food storage bags, and I would stick them in the Glad food storage bags.
That's funny.
That would kind of fold over, and, you know, they were much larger than the comic books, and I would keep them in piles on a bookshelf that I had.
What did your parents make of this? Were they really into you being into comic books? Were they like, what are you collecting there, Bob?
Not at all. Not at all. I mean, even as an adult, they would, like, you know, I'd see them after I'm, you know, graduated from college, have a good job, married, have kids, and they'd be like, you still reading those comic books? Like, yes, Mom. Yeah.
That's really funny. At some point, at some point, they would have to know, like, a little bit about what you were into. Like, did they have a hero they liked, or they just, like, I don't know.
No, they never had any real interest at all in them.
And so, were your friends into them at least?
I had friends that were into them. I mean, that was, you know, back then, you know, there were kids in the neighborhood that we all would read and talk about the comic books. And when the comic shop opened, I think the first comic shop opened that was close enough for me to ride my bike to in somewhere between 1976 and 1978. And then I would go there, and, you know, especially during the summer, you'd go there and you kind of hang around at the shop talking to people about comics. So, you know, I would get comics from way back before the comic shops. Every grocery store had a spinner rack of comic books in it. Every, you know, 7-Eleven type convenience store, or, you know, other kind of convenience store had comics. So they were within a short walk, maybe like a 15-minute walk or a, you know, 4 or 5 minute bike ride of my house. There were probably at least 7 or 8 places that I could buy comic books.
You know, when I was a kid,
really different than today, right?
Well, I remember going to, like, you know, 7-Elevens or convenience stores that were near me. We had comic book shops, obviously, but closest to me were, like, 7-Elevens or convenience stores, and they'd always have older comic books. They were never on time. They were never timely. And I guess back then they had to be a little bit more because there weren't comic book shops, like you say.
Yeah, that's why even to this day, if they put a month on the cover of a comic book, it's always, like, 2 months ahead, because that would be the date that they were supposed to leave it on the rack until. So, you know, the comic book that came out in March would have something like May on the cover of it.
Right.
So, you know, that just gave it a longer on sale period on the rack.
So when did you get really serious about collecting? I know you, you know, have kept everything for, you know, since that first year of Spider-Man you got rid of or, you know, messed around with. But when did you think this is the thing you really want to do and make your passion?
I mean, I never really thought of it that way. I mean, it was just something that I did. It was kind of like, you know, the person who, when they're a kid, they love the Yankees and, you know, they get their Yankee cap and their glove and their ball and they go to like every single home game that they can go to, and if, you know, they're ever on a trip and they, you know, they go to a ball game in some other town or something. It was just like that. It was just something that I did, and it was always something I did. It just, it was never something I consciously sat down and said, I'm gonna like comics a whole lot. I just did, and I always read. I just love the stories.
You know, what do you do for a living? Because did you ever think about working in comic books as someone who spent so much time reading them and collecting them? And
I never did. It was never an aspiration. You know, I was always technical. My brothers are older than I am, or I, you know, they're still around. I mean, my two brothers are 9 and 10 years older than me.
Okay.
So they moved out of the house when I was 11 or 12, you know, they graduated college and moved out, and they both went to college and got degrees in computer science. So I just followed in their footsteps. I mean, I was in, and this was like back in the stone ages of computers. I mean, I remember, you know, we did punch cards and things like that. It was, you know, back in the 70s. I was writing computer programs when I was in junior high school.
Wow.
Using cards that we would do the cards, and we would send the decks of cards into an LA Unified School District computer in a mailbag, and it would, you know, somebody would feed them in, and the program would run that we wrote, and we'd get a printout back like a week and a half later or something. High school, we had an actual Apple II computer, and we also had a dial-up into an LA mainframe computer that we could do programs on. And, you know, I went into computer science like my brothers, and I got a job at a computer place right after I graduated high school. One of my best friends, his dad worked there, and he got us both jobs there as computer operators. And what we would do is we would tear off printouts and we would mount tapes and, you know, do that kind of stuff. And after a couple of years, we were writing programs for the senior people there and just helping them do stuff. So I had always done the computer science stuff, and I moved from that. I got hired by a company called TRW that doesn't exist anymore. They got bought by Northrop Grumman right out of college. And a few years later, I was working on doing the Cheyenne Mountain upgrade for the Air Force, you know, and when they put a new missile warning center in, just like the general saw the movie War Games, if you remember that Matthew Broderick movie, and said, man, our system doesn't look anywhere near as nice as this. We better get a new system put in.
They were inspired by the Broderick movie?
Yeah. And so I worked on that for 9 years, and I moved on from that, got other jobs, you know, and right now I do consulting on information security and business continuity.
And so comic books are like, you know, for me, my whole life, I loved baseball as a kid, so I wanted to work in baseball, and I spent high school and college working for a minor league team. I interned for the Mets, and, you know, I love movies and I love TV shows and I love comics. So now I do this for a job. I always wanted to be probably unhealthily involved in the thing that I really am into. And I think it's awesome that you have this other life that is comic books and collecting that is not, you know, it's not your day job. It's not what you think about all the time. And it seems like it's kind of a safe haven, or, you know, an escape in a way.
Well, the interesting part is that the other people say, how do you afford to buy 120 comic books a month? It's like, it's because I'm not a struggling artist trying to make my own comic book. It's because I have a master's of science degree in computer science, and I get paid pretty well to do
Fair enough.
Computer science consulting. So I've got a wife and two kids in the house, and I've never really had a lot of problems in that area. But, you know, for the last 10 years or so, I've been really much more into kind of trying to give back and the fan aspects. I did in the early days of comic book podcasting, I co-hosted a podcast that we did for, I did it for 5 or 6 years. We did 300 regular episodes and a whole bunch of special episodes, over 600 hours of podcasting.
Wow. Got me beat.
It still runs. The guy that I did it with, his name is John Mayo. He does sales analysis on comic book resources, or CBR, okay, sure. I guess, .com. And his podcast is called Comic Book Page Podcast, and he still does that podcast. I stopped doing it back probably about 5 years ago, because the format of that show was always every week we would review a Marvel book, a DC book, and then some other indie book.
Okay.
And at a certain point in time, I was reading so few superhero books that I just couldn't do it justice, because I just didn't have enough of a depth of reading the superhero book to keep doing a Marvel, DC, and another. I was skewing much more toward the other.
Got it.
I started my Comic Spectrum webpage,
right,
where I have a lot of resources on there, but I do reviews on there as well. But then I have other people that, you know, also we're all just fans. I don't do it as a, I don't have ads. I don't do anything. It's not, people call me stupid. I don't try to monetize it at all. I just have this website.
God bless
you. I just want people to come and, you know, share my passion for comics. And I have other people, if somebody wants to write reviews for comics, we do reviews. So, you know, so I've got one guy who writes reviews that's a huge DC fan. So he writes reviews of DC books. I know a guy who loves manga. He does manga reviews for me, you know, and it's just, you know, we try to just cover the different aspects, and it's always fun. I encourage people to, you know, share their passion about these things. That's what we all want to do. I mean, you want to do that too with your show. You know, we like these things, and we want to tell people about this, because
sure,
it kind of charges our batteries, right? We love it.
And so what, you know, as you talk about being a fan, and you do this for the fandom, and like, that's why we're, you know, that's the podcast, The Fandom Files, but you've been doing this for so long. Have you made friends in the comic book industry on the professional side?
Yeah. In fact, that was as a result, mostly, I mean, to some extent, because I've been going to the San Diego Comic-Con since 1990.
Mm-hmm.
I've been there every year since 90, and it was a lot smaller back, you know, 10 plus, over 10 years ago. It was, you know, not anything like it's turned into
now.
Today.
Oh my God, it's a gigantic.
But yeah, what I loved about the San Diego Comic-Con was that it's not just the dealer floor with all the publishers and, you know, all that, but they would have all these panels about comic books, and the panels focused on the creators of the comic books. And then a lot of them would be down in Artist Alley, and I would meet a lot of these people down in Artist Alley. And then when comics podcasting started, the first comic podcast I came upon that's still around today is called Comic Geek Speak. If you or anybody in the audience ever heard of that one, it's the guys live in Reading, Pennsylvania. And that had like a whole fan community around it. And then that morphed off and split into, you know, there's some other podcasts like 11 O'Clock Comics. And, you know, other ones have grown out of that early podcast fandom.
Mm-hmm.
And just seeing those people, and then they would have a lot of creators come in and talk to them to promote their books. And when I was doing Comic Book Page, one of the things that I loved doing was I would do an interview show where I would just talk to a creator or a couple of creators, you know, for 15 or 20 minute segment. every month to talk about them and talk about what book they were coming out with. Now, these were mostly indie books.
Okay.
You know, even back then, I couldn't really talk about a DC book because DC has real, you know, it's like, if you want to talk to these people, you have to, you can only ask them these questions. And,
believe
you know,
me, I know.
You have to be, you have to be vetted and all this kind of stuff. And Marvel was the same way. So I would just talk to people about their own creator-owned stuff because they can say whatever they want about the about
that's
their own creator-owned book. But as a result, you know, I talked to Scott Snyder when he was writing, you know, Severed for Image Comics. And, you know, I would talk to, I think I talked to Rick Remender back when he was doing some stuff for Image or Dark Horse. And, you know, a lot of these guys who subsequently became hugely successful as Marvel and DC creators, you know, back kind of before they, quote unquote, hit it big. So that was always fun. And I still see a lot of these people. I haven't talked to, I remember one year I was at San Diego Comic-Con and I was just walking around and Scott Snyder saw me and just said, hey, Bob, you know, like he knew who the hell I was, you know, kind of an interesting treat. But, you know, that's the thing is I like helping those guys spread the word back then for however many, you know, like, at the time, you know, we probably had like, you know, 1,000 or 2,000 people downloading any given episode. So it's not like we had a humongous following of people that knew who we were. But, you know, hey, that's, you know, that's a couple of thousand people that, you know, it's the following was small, but it doesn't mean that it was any different for us because, you know, we were just happy to be talking about stuff that we loved.
Yeah, I mean, if you have 2,000 people listening and those people hadn't bought that comic book yet, that's a nice little sale, you know, nice little boost.
Well, I mean, that's the thing, too, because back, you know, even now, a lot of these indie books, I mean, they sell less than 10,000 copies. So if you can even, you know, if you could get like 200 people buying a copy of the book, it's going to be an actual noticeable, you know, percentage point increase in the sales of that. Book, you know.
Yeah, it makes a big difference. And so, you know, you talk about going to Comic-Con, you talk about meeting these people, and now, like you said, it's huge. I mean, Comic-Con, I work at Sci-Fi, and that is like our big, I mean, that's our Super Bowl, right? It's such a big thing. It's, I mean, it's more than comic books now. It's TV, it's video games, it's movies. What does it mean to you, or what do you make of it being so big now? Obviously, you don't dwell in the past. You like these new superheroes you don't worry about. You know, this is not my Iron Man, or but what do you make of it? Are you surprised by just how big comic books and quote unquote geek culture have gotten?
It's not surprising. It's people just finding out about it because all this stuff has always been the stuff that captures the imagination and is really, you know, there have been organized fandoms around sci-fi, you know, all the way back way before comic books in the 50s, you know, one of the first organized, probably the first organized fandom ever was sci-fi fandom.
Yeah.
Sherlock you know, Holmes. Where the people, you know, talked about all the stuff that they loved. So it's not really surprising. And, you know, I look at Comic-Con as something that it's like 15 different conventions, and every person who goes to San Diego Comic-Con can have a completely different experience at that con depending on what it is that they like. And people who are on the outside looking in don't really understand because they just see it through the lens of whatever media outlet is showing it, and they typically will show the flashiest stuff, you know, like whenever I say I'm going to a convention, people say, what are you dressing up as? Right. And I'm like, well, I don't dress up, but I'm not going to put on spandex. I like to take pity on my fellow man. No one needs to see me in a spandex Superman suit romping around Comic-Con. You know, when they show that, they focus in on the people wearing costumes and stuff. Sure. But, you know, you've been there, what, like maybe 10% of the people have like a costume on at that.
A very noticeable 10%.
But, you know, everyone else is, it's like kind of, and then like probably another, you know, probably up to like maybe 50% of the people have like, you know, superhero related t-shirts on, and probably somewhere like 40-50% of the people are just wearing normal clothes, you know, just there having a good time. So, sure. You know, there are people who go there because they want to see the Hollywood side, you know, the people who want to go and see the sci-fi booth, and near the sci-fi booth, you know, you got the Time Warner booth and the Nickelodeon booth, and you got that big cool Weta booth that's near you guys too, with all the Lord of the Rings stuff and all that. You know, people love seeing that. Some people like that. Some people like the cosplay. Some people like to buy toys and they like the exclusives that they have. Other people like comic books, you know, and just people say all the time, oh, there's no comics at Comic-Con anymore, which is so untrue because they don't look for them.
Right.
I mean, you know, if you go, there's like a whole area of the show floor is all people selling old comics, and that's just the show floor. I go upstairs and I spend almost all day, every day, going to different comic book related panels that are like creator driven, and you know, about the comics. I went to last year something like 23 different panels over the course of the 4 days, and they were all about comics. Nothing against the Hollywood panels, but I don't want to stand in a gigantic line, you know, out for Hall H. So I don't go to that, but some people like that. So that's their main thing. But I can walk into a room and I talk to Terry Moore, who created Strangers in Paradise. And, you know, there's like 50 people in that room, and we just get to sit and we talk with Terry for an hour, you know, on his panel.
Yeah.
You know, I talked to Maggie Thompson, who did the Comic Buyer's Guide for many years, and she's talking about Pogo. You know, she loves Pogo, and that's just a treat, you know, that I get to. And then afterwards, I got to have a conversation with her, and that was just a highlight of the show for me.
Yeah.
And, you know, just different things like that. But everybody who goes there can find what they want, you know, to have that con experience be like. You just have to kind of look for it. The thing that I find most disheartening is that since it sells out, it's really hard for people to actually be able to have that experience, because it is kind of a closed system at this point. It's just, you know, they sell out in like an hour or something,
right,
whenever they put the tickets out on sale.
And it's certainly, you know, it's certainly different from even when I was a kid. And you have two kids, and I wonder, are they really into comic books? Did you get them into it, or they sort of stay away because, you know, it's dad's thing?
My older son reads a lot of comics. He reads my comics. He doesn't really like them enough to buy his own comics that much, although he did buy, you know, he bought all the Adventure Time comics. He really likes Adventure Time.
Yeah.
And I don't like Adventure Time.
Oh, no.
So I wasn't about to buy the Adventure Time comics, but he bought them. But he mostly, you know, he'll read the different ones, you know, to his advantage, right? Since dad buys crazy amount of comic books,
my dad bought comics.
He can pretty much pick like the 10 or 15 that he likes and read them out of everything that I buy. So he likes Saga, and he likes Squirrel Girl, and he likes, you know, things like that. And, you know, so he'll pick his list of things and he reads those. My younger son, probably because my older son Steven and I both like the regular comics, he kind of went his own way, and he was really into manga.
And he
read lots of manga and was really into that, but didn't really get into the regular comics.
I mean, that's huge too, though. Now, I mean, it's absolutely gigantic manga anime.
Where they both followed me was another thing that I did that was geeky, which was Dungeons and Dragons. You know, I started playing Dungeons and Dragons in high school in like 1976, 77, when it was like first out.
Yeah.
So I had just tons of the D&D books, because I played Dungeons and Dragons throughout high school and college. And I even had a group that I played in after I graduated from college. So they grew up with that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And my older son has a D&D group that he's been hosting a game every week for probably the last 12 years.
Damn.
And you know, they go through the different games. Like sometimes they'll play like a Call of Cthulhu type of game, or sometimes they'll play like kind of a vampire one or superhero one. It's not always the fantasy D&D.
Okay.
But they've always played the different role-playing games. So they like that. And then they also really got into collectible card games. I played Magic a lot back in the days when it was first out. And so they inherited my Magic cards. So they play Magic and they play Yu-Gi-Oh!
You must have been the coolest dad to have. I mean, I swear to God, like, I go to the comic shop and blow, you know, 20, 30 bucks every, you know, every couple of weeks, but my dad now read comic books, so I'd save a lot of money. I can't imagine as a kid. It must have been the coolest.
I tried, you know. It's just, even now I come home and they're all playing D&D. I'll come home from the movies or something, and like I'll just sit and talk with them sometimes. I come back, like last Saturday, I came back from Free Comic Book Day with a couple of giant boxes of comics, and I'm like, Steven, go haul those two boxes in for me from the car. And his friends are all there, and like, what did you get? And I tell him, and
your house must be the coolest place to hang out with the kids. How old are your sons?
24 and 28.
Cool. So yeah, did all of your sons' friends want to hang out at your house all the time when they were growing up?
They all hang out at our house. Our house is the house where everyone is, because we've got like a big dining room. The dining room is the hangout room. It looks like the back room of a game store. It's just
so
got
cool.
Big piles of board games and D&D books and everything like that. And I don't, except for Christmas and Thanksgiving, when we clear out the room to actually have a big dinner on the big dining room table with the leaves in it that seats like 12 people, you know, it's pretty much, that's the gaming table every other weekend of the year.
Is your wife into these geeky things?
Not really, not at all.
Wow. She's a very patient woman.
She's a saint. She actually entered most of my comics into the database for me over the course of because she also had a computer science degree, but after my second son was born, we decided that she would be a stay-at-home mom because she really wanted to help raise. She wanted the kids to be raised as well as, you know, she could.
Sure.
And they kept getting sick in daycare and stuff. So it's like I had a good enough job that we didn't need the two incomes. So she stayed home, and she loved that. And as a result, you know, she was just like, well, I'll enter these comic books into the database for you. So she alphabetized them and entered most, you know, of those 100,000 comics into the database for me, because I used to keep them cataloged way back when on index cards.
How many index cards did you have?
Computers. Well, I had it in like little Rolodex kind of cases, little plastic cases you buy at an office supply store. I had like maybe 12 or 14 of those little cases that had index cards in them that I kind of created custom cards that I had printed up that, you know, each one held 100 comics on the front and 100 on the back. So each card was a title.
Wow.
A title that I had a lot of comics in, like Spider-Man or Batman or something. I would have maybe two cards or three cards or whatever. But, you know, I had hundreds of these cards. That was my initial way of keeping track of them. Then they all ended up in the database, so now they're all electronic.
I love that she's not really that into it, but she just has, you know, a husband and two sons that just spend, you know, so much time with it. That's patience. And what is she into?
Gardening, watching HGTV a lot. She likes she likes movies and stuff.
Okay.
We go to see movies. She'll go see The Princess Bride with me tonight.
Cool.
You know, she goes, you know, we go to see movies a lot.
Mm-hmm.
There are TV shows, you know, she watches The Walking Dead and Fear the Walking Dead with me.
Cool.
She loves both those shows. You know, we watch, you know, kind of like the geeky shows like that together.
Mm-hmm.
Game of Thrones, you know, she loves Game of Thrones. We watch that. you know, any of that kind of stuff. So she's into that stuff. Mm-hmm. Only comic book she ever really showed a tendency to like was Gru the Wanderer by Sergio Aragonés.
That's really funny. Of all things.
I don't know why, but she always liked that. Which is kind of fun.
It's goofy,
to con one time. Sorry?
It's a goofy, silly comic.
It is. We saw Sergio one time at a convention, and she was so thrilled to meet him and, you know, tell him about it. It was like the only comic she ever really, you know, read.
That's really fun.
It was fun.
So, you know, I don't want to take too much more of your time. I want to ask you a few quick questions. You know, you have, over 100,000 comic books. What was the one that was hardest for you to acquire that you wanted most?
Probably Amazing Fantasy 15.
Sure, the first Spider-Man.
Yeah.
And that's the Spider-Man guy.
I spent a really long time kind of researching about that and how to get it and, you know, just how to get the best deal on it. And, mm-hmm. you know, because it's not a cheap comic at any point in time.
No.
You know. So, you know, that one was the hardest one, probably.
Okay.
The one that I wanted for the longest amount of time.
I think I saw a photo on your site. It's signed by Stan Lee, the one you have?
Yes.
That's really cool. Would you say that's like a prized comic possession?
You know, from that respect, you know, what's even more prized for me is I have Amazing Spider-Man 88, which was that first comic
right.
that I read. Obviously, it's a replacement copy that I got a few years after I cut all the little characters out of it and stuff. But I have that autographed by Stan and John Romita Sr.
Oh, that's awesome.
And
that's
when
meaningful.
I met Stan to sign that one, and the reason that one means more to me is because this was before all the Marvel movies. It was probably more like around 2000 that mm-hmm. I met Stan at a local con. And there were like 100 people in line to see Stan compared to now when there's just, you know, hordes of people.
Sure.
And I was, you know, maybe 50th person in line. So I waited, you know, an hour or something to see Stan. And everybody in line had, you know, really key issues. You know, they'd have Spider-Man 1, Amazing Fantasy 15. They'd have Spider-Man 50, the famous one with the Spider-Man No More, you know, cover and things like that. And I come up to Stan and I give him Amazing Spider-Man 88. He like looks at it. He's like, I haven't seen this comic since I wrote it. Like, what made you bring this comic? I told him the story about it was the one that really captured my imagination. And I've been reading comics every month since then. And he's like, well, come around and get a picture with me.
That's
and, you
cool.
know, he called me around the table, put his arm around my shoulders and had somebody take a picture of us.
That's
and,
cool.
you know, so that was. Then, like a couple of years later, I met John Romita Sr. at San Diego Con, and same thing, and he signed it. So that one's probably the most precious to me for that reason.
Sure,
monetarily, it's not really worth a lot, but you know, just from the sentimental value.
Amazing Fantasy is quite a rare comic book. The 15 is quite a rare comic book. Do you have anything that's rarer, like the rarest comic book you have?
When you talk about rarity, it. You know, there's value and there's rarity.
Right.
So I have a lot of ash can and indie comic books that, you know, I bought from creators that legitimately there's only, you know, 100 copies of them in existence.
You know,
I like a comic called Copra by a guy named Michael Fife, who's actually doing a Bloodstrike for Image right now. And
cool.
he's done some stuff at Marvel. I really dig this guy's style. He does a really retro kind of superhero comic, very high energy.
Mm-hmm.
But I was getting this from a mail order when he was doing it. And he only made like a couple of hundred of each one of these comics. So when you really get down to it, there's way more copies of Amazing Fantasy 15
yeah.
kicking around out in the world than Copra and, you know, some of these other ones where there's only, you know, 100 or so of these small press books.
Fair. So as,
they're not worth what Amazing Fantasy is worth because of the whole supply and demand curve, right?
Yes. So as someone who reads so many comics a month, I'm sure people ask you all the time, what should I read? But what would you recommend to the listeners of this show? They should go to their local comic shop and pick up once they finish listening to this episode.
If what they should do is go to their local comic shop and talk to the person who runs the comic shop, tell the guy or girl at the shop what TV shows that they like, what movies they like, and what they like about those TV shows and movies. Mm. And then listen to the recommendations that the comic shop owner will come back to them with. Because different people are going to like different things, and it's going to be customized to their taste. I mean, because I can read, there will be a comic book that I read that I think is just wonderful. It's just like my favorite comic book. And someone else will read it and say, man, I hated that comic book. I couldn't stand it. And, vice versa. Somebody else will love something that I hate. Somebody will hate something that I love. So there's no single comic that I can recommend that everybody will like. But people tend to like, certain things. So if you just keep a mind out and just, if you want superheroes, let them know that you really like superheroes and what kinds of superheroes you like. And they can recommend for that person, certain story arcs with that hero and, certain titles that they're likely to enjoy. And then, a little experimentation probably is going to be needed, but you kind of feel around that. And then they should come up with their own personal customized list of, four, five, six comics that they really get a kick out of and really bring them a lot of enjoyment every month.
And so last question, what is your favorite comic book movie? Of the more recent ones.
Oh, wow. That's a tough one. Infinity War is really good, but, I really liked Homecoming last year.
Yeah, that was great.
I really liked Homecoming. Tom Holland really, and it just kind of goes back to that Spider-Man thing with me.
Yeah.
But just that youthful fun and exuberance and the joking and the kind of jumping around and everything, even though it was not straight out of the comics, there were a lot of changes that, but instead of focusing on those, I focused in on the tone of that movie really captured kind of the essence of Spider-Man for me.
Yeah, no, I agree. I love the Tobey Maguire movies, so I never thought I would find someone who liked better, but I mean, Tom Holland is a different type of Spider-Man, but certainly the most fun one we've had.
Yeah, I really liked the second Tobey Maguire one with Alfred Molina. Doc Ock.
Yes.
I mean, Doc Ock was the bad guy in that first one, and Molina did a great job as the bad guy in that. But, Tom Holland, and even in Civil War, I mean, Civil War was an awesome movie.
Yeah, he was fun.
Infinity War was really great. I mean, a lot of these Marvel movies, I loved Black Panther. Marvel has been doing a good job with the movies because I think they take an amalgamation of elements from a lot of different story points that have been done over the years, like popular ones, and they kind of take and build something out of the best elements out of a whole bunch of different stories, and they really put a lot of heart in those movies.
Yeah.
Which comes across on the screen.
Yeah, they're not enslaved to the storylines of the movies, but they, there's little elements that readers can pick up on.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, and I love the Thor Ragnarok. I think it might have been my favorite of the last few years.
That was a fun movie, too. I mean, it's hard to pick for me with the Marvel movies because each one has had a lot of fun elements to it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, look, I know you got to go see The Princess Bride tonight, so I'm going to let you go. Thank you so much for taking the time to come on the show.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I always love to talk about comics with people who love comics.
So what is the website when people want to come read about your collection, they want to read about your reviews, they want to talk with you about comic books, what is the website that they should go check out?
It's comicspectrum.com, all one word, comicspectrum.com, and the same thing on Facebook. I tend to put, more frequent little things up on Facebook. I'll publish, you know, formal reviews or articles or something a little less frequently on the website, but I put stuff up on Facebook a lot more frequently.
All right, cool. Well, I will have everyone, you hear that, everybody, go check out Comic Spectrum on Facebook. Thanks so much for your time, Bob. This is really awesome.
Oh, and if they go there, if they look at the Bob's blog on the menu there, they can find pictures of my comic book room, which a lot of people are impressed by.
It is a very cool room. It is. I can see why kids wanted to hang out at your house. That is a really cool room. A lot of cool toys.
Very good. Well, thanks for having me.
All right, everybody. Thanks so much for listening. You can find The Fandom Files on iTunes and everywhere that podcasts are given away for free. You can follow us on Twitter @FandomFilesSciFi. Till next time, Jordan Zachary for The Fandom Files.